Hey everybody, welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of October 10th, 2019. This week, we are talking about Scorsese's controversial comments on Marvel movies not being cinema. We are talking about The Joker. The tech news this week is macOS Catalina, which is a big deal for filmmakers, and you got to pay attention to it. And Ask No Film School this week is, hey, give me a little guidance on festival strategy. That is all of the stuff happening this week on the No Film School podcast. All right, our top story this week on the No Film School podcast. We can almost guarantee you've been talking about it with your friends. We've been talking about it with our friends. Martin Scorsese, as close as we get to a cinema god in 2019, in an interview made a comment that he does not consider Marvel movies to be cinema. He considers them theme park attractions. That is not a direct quote. That is paraphrasing. So I don't know if we have the direct quote in front of us. I don't know.
I do.
Let's read the direct quote.
I don't see them. I tried, you know, but that's not cinema. Honestly, the closest I can think of them, as well-made as they are with the actors doing the best they can under the circumstances, is theme parks. It isn't the cinema of human beings trying to convey emotional, psychological experiences to another human being. I should have tried to do a Martin Scorsese impression there, but I have no confidence that I could do an even passable version. So,
I mean, I have a theory that the last acceptable impression is Italian. Like, everything else is offensive, but if you do, like, a very exaggerated Italian chef impression, it's not offensive. But I honestly think it might be offensive to lay in with too heavy on a Marty Scorsese impression. You might end up canceled. Cancel culture might come for you. So,
that opens up a whole other topic for us to discuss. Cancel culture. Possibly on this podcast. But he talks real fast. That's the real hallmark.
Look, here's the thing. Anyway. First off, this is a really great example of someone giving a very nuanced comment in which he attempts to be very generous to the filmmakers involved and all of their fine craft work, and then talk about a distinction. And he clearly says it's personal for him about what he's looking for cinema and what those movies are trying to do. So it is a very nuanced statement that Scorsese makes. And then in classic internet fashion, it becomes a meme. And the meme is, Scorsese says Marvel movies aren't cinema, which is obviously what I had heard by the time I heard it and what I repeated at the top of the podcast. So it's a really great example of a nuanced statement getting reduced to something that is both more offensive and lacks all the context of the original statement. The context being, hey, I think the people are working really hard on these. I think there's a lot of craft going into these. I think, you know, there's a lot of effort, but what they're interested in and what I'm interested in about cinema are different things, which I think is a fair statement. What's interesting for me is I also thought he was going to talk about something which is an important distinction for me about cinema, especially in the age of streaming, which is one of the things I love so much about cinema is a sense of completeness. Like when you watch Casino and you get to the end of Casino, it is a complete unified work of art that is not, it does not require you to have watched two movies before or three movies later. It does not require, it is not transmedia. It is a self-contained unit. And I love a self-contained unit. Like, I remember being young and like reading a really great book and like you finish the book and like the world looks different because of the emotional experience of the book. Every once in a while, a movie does that for me in a way that almost never happens with streaming media. Or with with big complicated transmedia, because a really great ending can be so powerful. And like Scorsese movies, there's three or four Scorsese movies where the endings are just so good. I mean, Gangs of New York, a complicated movie, but the ending of the movie where these two protagonists you've been fighting with, you've been identifying with and engaged with for so long, and then out of nowhere, this big wave of history comes and just crushes them. And you're like, oh, their fight doesn't matter compared to the Civil War. Like this thing that you've invested in so much gets robbed. Like it's such a great ending. It's so powerful. And like you can't do that across eight movies. You can't do that when there might be a sequel and then we get more Bill the Butcher back from the grave. Like there's something that he is interested in.
Bill the Butcher verse, the cinematic Bill the Butcher.
Oh my God. I would actually, that being said, I would totally see Gangs of New York 2 with a zombie Bill the Butcher. I would absolutely watch that. Daniel Day-Lewis into playing a zombie, which, you know, somebody could. P.T. Anderson could talk him into it.
Well, given the Joker, the door, all kinds of doors are open. I think it's interesting on many levels that you point out the fact that it's a quote taken out of context and memeified. What's weird about that is that the internet culture has a way of then like snowballing. And we also have, you know, we wrote about the Scorsese quote, and we also wrote about the reactions of some of the filmmakers. There's a lot of filmmakers who immediately on Twitter and such were responding. James Gunn, who made the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, the first two and a few others, had a comment where he said, "Martin Scorsese is one of my five favorite living filmmakers. I was outraged when people picketed Last Temptation of Christ without having seen it. I'm saddened that he's judging my films in the same way." And you can only imagine what that opened up, because then it was, well, is this a false equivalency? And, you know,
it's, I mean, I think that is a false equivalency. I think we can all fairly say that.
Okay, yeah.
picketing a movie because someone dared to make a movie in which we tried to explore what Christ might have been like if he was actually a person and what he might have struggled with, which I think is a really interesting thing for someone who, like, you know, I believe in God. I'm interested in, like, I don't know where I fall on all of the tenets of faith, but, like, I find it really fascinating to try and struggle with, like, what that person is as a person. And religious zealots being like, "You're not even allowed to make that movie," is a completely different thing than someone saying, "Yeah, your movies make like $1 billion, but I'm going to do something else with my Saturday night." Like, that's a very different thing.
I like James Gunn, and I actually really like Guardians of the Galaxy. The first one is like, I'm, you know, from where I'm coming from is that I'm not a big comic book movie fan, and I never really have been, which is not to say that I'm not a nerd, because I absolutely am, but that's just not my cup of tea. And so when I saw Scorsese's comments, I thought, yeah, I totally get it. I have also tried. And when I watch them, they do not connect with me. I saw the first Avengers. I watched Black Panther. Like, I've seen a bunch of them over the years. I just never got wrapped up into it. I was kind of like, nah, I could take it or leave it. And I get where he's coming from, which is he's saying, I'm impressed by it. I'm impressed by the craft. And actually, I would say I really enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy. That's one of the ones I actually really liked. But my point is, just my opinion, my tastes aside, I think that James Gunn's reaction was kind of part of the snowballing of reactions, where it was like, oh, now it's being, you know, Martin Scorsese was receiving death threats. And I think that what over The Last Temptation of Christ, I think what's happening with James Gunn's comments is he's like, I'm feeling like I'm being put on blast and I'm being judged and it's not fair. But I think that's because perhaps he was taking Scorsese's comments a little bit out of context, like you're saying. The thing that's interesting to me about it is that, and I wrote about this when we covered it on No Film School, the Joker, which I don't know if we need to segue to the next thing yet, but Joker is a comic book movie by way of Martin Scorsese's human cinema, like literally. So it was fascinating to me that Martin Scorsese's quote about comic book movies versus cinema was coming in just before the wide release of this movie that's very buzzy and that does something no comic book movie has done, which is tried to infuse it with, I don't know what you'd call it, cinematic realism that comes from things like Taxi Driver and King of Comedy. So it just felt like, I don't know, is he going to see that movie? I'd love to know what he thinks of it personally, and how he compares it. But that being said, as far as the Scorsese's comments on Marvel, it seems totally fair to me. A lot of people would look at Star Wars, even the original, which I think is a great movie, and say, that's not cinema. That's not about people. That's about spaceships. And I would say, yeah, you know, fair, right?
Well, except the original Star Wars. I mean, whatever you think of the whole extended universe, that original Star Wars movie is just so great because it is so rooted in, you know, like, Luke Skywalker is a fascinating, relatable character, even when he's whiny. And, you know, Han Solo is someone that, like, we all kind of went to high school with someone that was, like, a couple years older than us and had a lot of swagger. And, like, you know, you can totally see that Luke, Han, like, it is a very youthful dynamic. Like, as an adult, there's no one that, like, is swaggering around my life shooting people that everybody else wants to be like. But, like, in high school, that's a, you know, it is a very relatable dynamic to a certain
phase. Yeah, there's also the men, he has, the, you know, the mentor relationship and the relationship
with Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
There's so but much I would there. Say it's a rich movie.
It's an amazing movie. Yeah, you don't have to convince me. Yeah. I think it's one of the best. But I think that there's a, like, in, if you could go into the context of that time when there's movies like All the President's Men and Network coming out, I could see a lot of people saying, this is the cinema we know. This is not like the 12 Angry Men or the drama. I mean, cinema has, that Martin Scorsese's talking about, I think, has really fallen into, you know, a smaller percentage of what's occupying major movie theaters compared to the theme park version.
Well, and actually,
like you said,
The Irishman isn't even going to be showing in major movie theaters. In New York, they're renting out a Broadway theater for a month and installing a digital projector to show it in New York because none of the major theater chains in New York would show it. So we're all going to be seeing it in like a 1,000-seat Broadway theater, which is kind of exciting, and I'm looking forward to that aspect of it. But it's certainly not, you know, it is... There is a moving target that's happening here where the theatrical experience is pivoting towards like more of a theme park kind of feeling. And that is absolutely a realistic observation on Scorsese's part. It's also just really fascinating to me because I can't imagine, I don't know, like I make things and I share them with the world and I'm excited about them. And I've got this web series coming out soon, Salty Pirate, and I'm super proud of it and very excited about it. But like, I'm totally okay if anybody's like, oh, that's a business web series. I'm not into business stuff. Like, I totally am fine with that. And it doesn't hurt my feelings if someone watches the trailer and is like, oh, it seems like business drama. Like, it just doesn't bother me.
I mean, we do what we can do, right? Like, I mean, if Martin Scorsese, who I highly respect,
yeah,
were to see something I did and be like, oh, that's just like a goofy horror comedy, I would say, whoa, it's kind of cool that Martin Scorsese's radar.
Yeah,
like that would be the extent of my like, why did he watch it? Like, yeah. Like I wouldn't necessarily curl up and say, oh God, he's judging me unfairly. Which is, again, I'm not trying to pile on James Gunn, who I think is awesome.
James Gunn I also saw the original Guardians of the Galaxy. It was one of the first dates my wife and I ever went on. We had a really enjoyable date that night. We talked a lot about the movie. We both agreed that it was pretty, like, that there was a lot of good stuff in it. Like, it was, I like the original Guardians of the Galaxy. James Gunn seems like an interesting guy. But the thing for me is this interesting thing that seems to be happening where, like, there is a segment of the culture that seems to view anyone not liking their thing as being somehow like the enemy or hating. But it's like, I definitely live in a world where I'm like, I know I am interested in my things and I'm only interested in like making the shit I want to make. And I'm hoping that some small segment of the population is interested in it. But I have no offense if a whole bunch of motherfuckers are not interested in it. But there is
Absolutely.
Some weird thing about a certain subset of culture where they seem to view anybody not being interested in it as like a personal insult. And that, I don't think James Gunn is going through that, but I think there is some phenomenon going on here where, like, you know, people are interested in this thing and they feel persecuted for that interest, which is weird because these are like billion-dollar franchises. So, like, clearly many people like them. So I don't know who the imagined persecutor is, but there is sort of like an interesting thing here where Scorsese is then getting associated as being some sort of like snob or highbrow or like representative of highbrow culture in a way where it's
I mean, I think that it's like, I think you make a great point. And I think that it's like we niche culture is so important. And finding your niche within
niche culture. It's all
right.
Niche
I was going to say that right.
There is no monoculture anymore.
Right. So the most important thing we can do as both fans and as creators, if we're one or both, is find and connect to the stuff that is our niche.
Yeah.
And find the other people that connect to it. And don't worry about the people who hate. Like this is the perfect time to be a niche creative because there's so many platforms that you don't have to worry about the fact that you're not making what is called a four quadrant movie because those things don't really need to be made anymore. And
well,
so
it's also
we
like
can,
if you were really into comic books in the 50s, you did not have an avenue to become a millionaire. But there are like millionaire comic book nerds who like turned their comic book nerdery into writing comic book screenplays or directing comic book movies, or like, you know, comic book nerdery is now an avenue towards riches in a way that it was not in 1970 or 1960.
I know a handful of guys who work regularly in TV and they started making comic books. Yeah. And I know that, and they're not making comic book movies today. Yeah. So you can find your audience, and that's the coolest thing. You don't have to worry about the audience that hates what you do. They exist. They're always going to exist. And, you know, Marvel is like, you know, one of the biggest names in town, and they're making really big stuff that's sort of connecting to everybody. But I think it's really important to remember that a movie's ticket sales or box office today is not reflective of the amount of people going. The tickets are more expensive. So there's a lot of people who are going to movies you're not going to, and those movies can still be successful. Just like there's a lot of people watching a show that no one else is watching that can still be successful. Like,
well, also,
like you said, there's no monoculture. So niche stuff is cool.
Let's go back 20 years and try and remember what movies from the early 2000s or late 90s do we still talk about? Like, you had that great post a couple of weeks ago about the 90s being the peak of late 99 being the best year of movies ever, right? I don't remember in detail.
Yeah, one of them. Thank you.
Yeah. And you listed a whole bunch of great movies, which, like, I liked a lot of those movies. I don't remember if the box office listing for 1999 came up in your post, but I have a sneaking suspicion if you went back and looked at the top box office earners for that year, they did not make your list of the reason why 1999 is the best reason.
Yeah, year of cinema. It's funny. I did put the list on there, but it's a great point because Star Wars Episode One like set all the records that year, and there were a few movies on the top 10 list in terms of earnings that were really important. You would say, in terms of lasting impact, maybe The Sixth Sense being one of them. But there were also things like, you know, that were like a couple rom-coms that, you know, they're fine. But like that was what was making a lot of money in 1999. Whereas, you know, Three Kings, which is an incredibly important movie, or Election, or American Movie, or what were some
Magnolia.
Of the other ones? Magnolia or even Fight Club. The Matrix made a lot of money and was amazing. Or Office Space. I mean, there were some really interesting movies happening that have lasted in the culture in 1999 that were not top 10 box office earners. So that's a great point.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, like, the movies that stick with us. It's also that thing, I'm now getting old enough where I'm kind of annoyed at how much everyone talks about box office numbers. Like, this week I've already had, like, two or three conversations about, like, Joker breaks October records with people who don't even work in movies. And I'm like, how is October records even a thing that you think about? Like, how is that even, like, we draw this weird box around it and it becomes a headline. And I'm like, shouldn't we be talking about, like, what's in the movie and the content of the movie? And, like, we don't talk about this.
It's a PR thing. Yeah.
Sure, but, like, we don't let other companies' PR do the same thing. Like, Samsung could totally be, like, the best sales month for a phone in any October. They could do that. And, like, I'm sure they do that. I'm sure Samsung has press releases that, like, the S8 is the fastest-selling phone in the first 2 weeks of release, and it doesn't become something. You know, my brother-in-law has a Samsung, and I've never heard him say, well, you know, the Samsung, best-selling phone in the first 2 weeks of release. Like, it's – with some companies, we just ignore their press releases because I'm sure Samsung rolls that press release out, but we just don't do it. But somehow the movie industry has done this really good job of – or movie business press, because that's actually different than movie marketing. I know a lot of people in movie marketing, and they're very, like, content-focused and trying to find the right angle that shares the people.
That's a different, right.
But, like,
good distinction.
But, like, studio-level marketing, where they care about the stock price of the studio, which is, I think, different marketing people, because I don't seem to know any of those folks, do this great job of creating this one weird little walled garden of, like, the best October opening ever. And it's like, is that good? Are October openings, like, a thing that normally we care about?
I think there's also, like I said, it's so, when you really dig into those numbers, because of ticket prices and because of inflation and because of numbers of tickets sold, there's so many ways you can break it down analytically and see that, like, biggest this year doesn't mean much compared to much historically. But I think that it's because internally it's a measuring stick. So they'll create momentum. Like, by saying that, it's like everyone is seeing it. You've got to see it too, right? That becomes the story.
No, I mean, that's very like, much why they market that.
It's the biggest thing. Right.
They're trying to get a big second weekend out of how big the first weekend was. And the fact, and it's also, it's hard to market movies because you can't really spoil plot elements and such. So I understand why it becomes a thing in movie marketing, but it's so weird to me that like so many of the people I know in my life who don't work in movies talk about box office numbers. It's like, you know, because like I have friends who work in other industries and I don't talk to them about their sales figures. I talk to them about like the products they're selling and what's going on in that world and like what are they making and like except I do know some, I have like friends of friends who work at WeWork and there was a lot of discussion of their IPO, but just because their S1 was fucking insane. But that's a completely different issue. And if their S1 had not been nuts, we wouldn't have talked about it as much.
I think the other weird one, but we don't, this is a real other, this is a whole other topic, but people also talk a lot about movies in terms of the awards. And if you're inside of the industry, like it's, those are internal industry awards, even though it's a major televised event, at least one industry award show is, but industry awards and other, like people aren't like, hey, did you hear about that commercial that won the Clio or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's not like the other industries when they give awards within to one another that they vote on that are subjective. It's like there aren't people on the outside who are talking about the phone that won best. I mean, it might be something you would see in a press release, but again, it's like it's not the mass culture. Every time people outside of the industry talk about movies that won awards, I say, have you ever looked at the list of best pictures winners all time? There's a lot of movies that no one ever talks about that no one would ever go see.
Well, so, George, what you're telling me is you don't watch the yearly J.D. Power and Associates Best Customer Service in Car Industry Awards? Because I tell you what, you are missing a red carpet, motherfucker. Holy cow. Those folks from Dodge roll up.
What about their gowns?
Yeah. I mean, Mary Barra, every year in GM, it's like an Instagram sensation what she wears to the J.D. Power and Associate. I don't even think most industries have a big event where they give out statues. I think in the Clios they do. But J.D. Power, I think it's just a press release. I don't even know that. Yeah, and Consumer Reports is definitely not giving out awards. All right, this is the perfect segue to Joker, which is the other thing we need to talk about. I, full disclosure, have not seen it, but we're talking about it anyway because we had a big article about whether or not to see it on the site. George, have you seen it now?
I have seen it.
Interesting.
I saw it because I didn't feel like... Yeah, so I didn't really... I wasn't super excited to see it. I guess, like I said, comic book movies are not really my cup of tea, but it was, I mean, just for a little background for our listeners, we put a post up on No Film School, and that was really an opinions piece. We don't usually do that. Historically, we haven't had a lot of things on the site that were more rooted in a take about a movie or its impact or the responsibility of the filmmaker. We're rarely critical of filmmakers, but we took a chance doing this and I was okay with it because this movie is a topic of discussion in the community in a way that we don't get movies often these days to be in a big way. I'm not being articulate here, but like this movie is a big conversation topic in the filmmaking community beyond just the film viewing community. And so doing something like this at this time felt like the right move to me, even though it was a little out of step with things we've done in the past. And the reaction was strong in a very negative, angry direction, which was interesting on its own. And that's something this movie is just doing. Like people are really polarized about it. Not even about the craft of it. So when that happened and I was seeing like the comments pouring in and, you know, of course the Facebook stuff went crazy, I thought, we have to talk about this now on the podcast and I have to see this movie because I felt like it was, you know, the right thing to do, given the context. And, you know, for people who listen and read it or people who are angry about it, I do kind of just want to say it's sometimes, I think, worth it to take chances and do different kinds of things. And I think it was worth it in this instance. But we definitely heard loud and clear how people felt about it. And it will inform the kinds of posts we do in the future.
Well, we heard loud and clear how the actively, like how people who are very communicative feel about it. Like, I remember seeing that post come up in my feed, because I'm a No Film School reader as much as I'm a writer. And I saw it come up in the feed. I didn't know it was coming because, you know, you guys are all in L.A. and I'm in New York and I'm not privy to those conversations. And I was like, oh, yeah, I like this take. And I didn't go out of my way to comment on it. I didn't go up. But I was like, yeah, I mean, I think we as human beings and as participants in culture can decide based on marketing that we just don't feel like participating in a movie. And like, we can make that decision even when we're like, ooh, this movie looks well made and well acted and Joaquin Phoenix is really fascinating. We can still make the decision to be like, you know what? I don't actually feel like participating in that for whatever reason. And I think we have the like, I think that was like an interesting take from Phil that I kind of was like, yeah, okay. I knew it was going to piss some people off.
The only thing I want to interject that I forgot to add is that this was Phil's opinion about why he didn't want to support the movie and why he was urging people to also not support the movie. And so it was a very actively, like, it was almost a boycott. It was a call for a boycott of sorts. And I felt like, yeah, we can try that. Like, that's just to give context, that's the meat of what it was. And he lays out the reasons why. And I'm not, No Film School as a publication does not agree with those views necessarily. It doesn't hold views like that as a thing.
Do we have an opinion or editorial banner? Because like when I read David Brooks in the New York Times, I'm aware that no one at the New York Times agrees with David Brooks or Brett Stevens. So like I'm assuming.
It says opinions on it. Opinions on it. And we don't usually do that either, but I felt like that was important.
So wait a minute. Can I start writing opinion pieces?
Uh-oh. Here we go. Let's get to it. It's worth considering. That's part of why I wanted to do it. But I also, I went and saw the movie. So I didn't take the movie, the post's advice. If that, like, people who are at No Film School went and saw the movie despite this being the opinion of someone at No Film School. But I want to just say, you know, as far as, one of the only ways that audiences can impact what's being made is by deciding whether or not to go see it, right? So it's fair for someone to say, I choose, like you're saying, to not see this and support it. And these are my reasons. And I thought that was interesting, given the climate, given the movie itself, given that it's a discussion point.
So I actually have a different take on this, which is I think that there are two kinds of boycotts we can create as audiences. There is the I will not participate in your conversation boycott, and then there's the I will not give you money boycott. And I'm going to reveal a little bit of law breaking in my youth. And I, you know, I'm doing this at great personal risk. There's a studio involved that I stole from, and they may never want to work with me now, but I'm going to go ahead and lay it all out on the line. And I'm going to admit that I wanted to see Passion of the Christ because I was interested in Mel Gibson as a filmmaker. And I thought his earlier work was interesting, and I wanted to participate in the cultural conversation around that movie and be able to talk about it articulately. But based on wide standing reports that it was likely bordering on anti-Semitic, I didn't want to give money to The Passion of the Christ. So I paid for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and I snuck into Passion of the Christ. I realize this is breaking the law. I can't believe that I'm confessing to this on a public podcast.
You'll never work in this town again, Charles.
I know, right? This is like a huge revelation. But I did it because I wanted, because there are both of those things, right? Like, movies are part of this cultural thing. And, you know, there is certainly the decision. There's one decision of like, what am I willing to consume and what am I not willing to consume? What voices am I willing to listen to or not listen to? Do I think I can critically listen to a voice like and watch it with reserve? Because like, you know, in every film school, at some point or another, you watch Triumph of the Will, which is pro-Nazi propaganda, and you watch it. And, you know, at this point with historical remove, I don't think that Triumph of the Will has converted any film students into being Nazis. But if Triumph of the Will made you a Nazi, please let us know on Twitter at No Film School.
Oh, no, please don't.
But there's also the financial, like, I chose to have a financial boycott where I was like, based on all the information I have, it seems likely that this movie is probably trafficking in anti-Semitic tropes that I did not want to financially support. And I really liked Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which I still really like. I'd already seen it once in the theater, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to give another dollar to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, or $5 or whatever movies was 20 years ago. And I'm going to then sneak in, break the law in order to hold to my principles, because principles are more important, you know, the moral right is more important than the legal right. Hold to my principles of not supporting a movie that I suspected. But the problem with movies goes back to that same thing we were talking about with marketing. I don't know if the movie's anti-Semitic until I see it. The trick with movies is we pay for the thing before we consume it. I don't know, because I've not seen it yet, if Joker is overly sympathetic to, like, one of the things you hear a little bit about with Joker is some people are like, this is way too sympathetic to, like, you know, incel, alt-right, like, violence.
The thing about Joker is it's about a criminal. It's about a mentally unstable man. It's presented in a way that's extremely raw and cinematically realist, I guess. I don't know how to say it. It's realism by way of Scorsese, like I said before. It's a comic book character who appeals to children traditionally, but presented in a way that no child should be witness to ever. Don't take your kids to see this movie under any circumstances. And I've heard stories of people who did, which, you know, that's part of the problem, right? It presents violence in a way that's cathartic, heroic, criminal violence in a way that's heroic, which, you know, we've seen before. There's less violence in this movie than there is in John Wick or in, God, any number of movies. There's even less blood, but it's the way the violence is depicted. It's the way it works within the story. It's the way the character's relationship to crime and violence becomes part of his self-realization and heroism, and the way that that, and anti-heroism, and the way that that relates to the culture right now when there's a lot of violence happening. Is there more than there ever is? But in this sort of, in this way, this type of violence happens in America, in the world, from people who feel like loners and outsiders, who are angry, who are maybe mentally ill, who maybe get their hands on a gun. There's a lot of parallels that are extremely uncomfortable to real life situations that have been horrific. And the movie pulls no punches in terms of the depiction of that stuff. But then at the end of the day, this is the Joker. This is Cesar Romero and Jack Nicholson and Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger, come on. And Jared Leto, let's not forget.
And Jared Leto. And so, like, there, it's uncomfortable, and it's on purpose. And the thing that is worth keeping in mind is that what is the question to ask is, what is the responsibility of filmmakers to all of these things and to audiences, to have a point of view, to be careful depicting these things? Do they have any at all? And I think that's a conversation worth having. And again, that's why I like the post, because I like the idea of that conversation taking place. And I think that, you know, for my part, I didn't see Passion of the Christ, not for boycott reasons, but partly because it just seemed like, ooh, I don't know if I want to do that. Like, I don't know if I want to go through that from what I've heard. I like Braveheart, but Braveheart's a little, you know, for me, it's like, I think Mel Gibson gets a little too deep on the, you know, self-flagellation and such. But I, you know, for Joker, I went and saw it for the reasons I said. It's, you know, for my personal take was just, I can see why people are upset. My biggest beef with it, honestly, is that it's really not original, and it's a shame, because it does so much that's just right out of King of Comedy and Taxi Driver and other movies of that time, that I just kind of wish there was an idea there, like something like the opportunity to say, I want to make a movie about the Joker, but I want to make it real feeling. But it doesn't feel real, because it just feels like Scorsese from that period, which, if you're a film goer and you have never seen Taxi Driver or King of Comedy, I can completely understand why you would see this movie and say it is monumental. But if you have and they're fresh in your mind, I think you're more likely to say, yeah, that's kind of, I've seen it before.
So it's interesting, because I still haven't seen Joker. I'm not boycotting it. I will probably get around to seeing it. I have a one-year-old, and that means you have to be very selective about when you get to see movies. And the movie that I'm holding out to have my wife watch the baby for I will be seeing The Irishman at some point in November, which means I don't get to see a movie in October, probably, you know, because one-year-old.
I get it. Yes. Yeah.
But my hope about this is what I had hoped based on early initial reports, because, you know, like, there's this amazing sequence in Wolf of Wall Street in which they start singing, you know, they're doing cocaine or, you know, some, or they're doing a drug in the back of a, in the back of a bar, and they start singing all these like pop culture songs. And like, for me, it's really about the way in which like broken people cling to media for identity. Like Jordan Belfort is so broken that he's like attaching to the Wizard of Oz looking for identity. And I think that like we, you know, the more broken you are, the more you look outside of yourself for fragments of identity to attach to. And I also think that's like a stage in human development where like as we grow, we look outside to culture to help us build an identity. So my hope about the Joker was that it was really sophisticated in the way in which it paralleled the characters looking outside itself for cultural artifacts like clowns to attach an identity to, with this like echoing of these cultural artifacts, Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, that are still echoing into our society today. And I was really hoping, because like, you know, for months now we've been hearing about the huge influence of those two movies on this one, and I was thinking it might have been a sophisticated take. But if it's just sort of a like pastiche thing that doesn't really add or echo or talk about like fractured identity in that way, it's probably less engaging. I will absolutely end up seeing it, but it sounds more and more like I'm going to watch it on a plane. Which, you know, no insult.
No, I mean, and I think that there's a couple other things to mention that, I want to make it clear that this is, I'm bringing this up because I saw a commentary about our post that mentioned this, which is, what about the craft of the movie? Like No Film School talks about things like how the movie was made. The movie is beautiful. It's shot beautifully. The art direction is phenomenal. The specificity of the recreation of this time and space in, you know, it's Gotham, but it's Gotham's always been New York, but wow, is it New York here? And that specific New York and the recreation of that is so cool to behold. I have a friend I talk to about movies a lot here. He writes too in LA. And we always have this thing where we don't see eye to eye on things, which is that he can appreciate a movie that is technically excellent, but maybe has story and screenplay issues. I personally have a really hard time with that. Everybody has their things that are kind of sticking points. This movie, if you don't mind derivative story points, if you don't mind like script, you know, imperfect plotting or not super surprising, then, you know, and maybe some problematic scenes in terms of the writing, then you will probably enjoy it because it's really a masterpiece of execution. I personally get a little more into the story side, but the movie looks and sounds incredible. And I, you know, that's objectively, I think that's true. I also would say objectively from a screenplay standpoint, it's weak.
This week's episode of the No Film School podcast is brought to you by FilmTools.com. Since 1996, FilmTools has been Hollywood's one-stop shop for all things production. No matter your filmmaking needs, FilmTools has you covered when you need gear for your next shoot. This week, FilmTools is offering No Film School listeners 5% off qualifying purchases when they shop at FilmTools.com. All you have to do is enter code NFSPOD at checkout. That is NFSPOD at checkout to get 5% off your purchases at FilmTools.com. Whether you need a new stinger, a GoPro, or a cart, make sure you head over to FilmTools.com and use code NFSPOD at checkout to get 5% off your next equipment purchase. All right, up next, tech news. So this week in tech news, we've got to talk about it. macOS has upgraded to macOS Catalina. I guess if you're a PC user, you can maybe skip this section, but you know, it's still good to know what is going on over in the Mac universe because a lot of the film industry runs on Mac, whether you personally run on it or not. The big thing to know about the Catalina switch is that it is switching from, you know, macOS has been 64-bit for a while, but it still allowed you to run 32-bit apps. Now, with Catalina, you are no longer going to be able to run 32-bit apps. When you install it, it's going to show you a list of the apps you can no longer run. So, first off, if you're a professional filmmaker in the middle of a project, never upgrade your software. Always finish your project and deliver and then upgrade. This is why TV networks upgrade in July and August. Film schools upgrade in July and August. The chances of like a bug or a feature breaking that you depend on, always wait on the upgrade. I'm personally upgrading.
This is a PSA.
Yeah. Literally, I'm upgrading to Catalina on my personal laptop in the background right now because, you know, I like to test the new OS on my personal equipment where I don't have like a whole bunch of like tight deliveries. And then, you know, once I've tested it on Catalina, we will talk. You know, I work at a film school, Feuerstein Graduate School of Cinema. We will talk as a film school about whether or not it is time to upgrade based on the new features. But this transition is a big one. We don't always talk about every transition, but dropping 32-bit apps is a big one. And the reason why is because filmmakers often stay attached, especially to like weird random plugins, but also old versions of software for way longer than normal people. Normal people will do this upgrade and will probably not miss anything. But many filmmakers are going to be like, no, but there's this plugin I bought in 2011 and it's 32-bit and the maker went out of business, but I depend on it every day for audio sweetening or something. So common with filmmakers. So you should really be on the lookout for whether or not there's newer versions, 64-bit versions of all your favorite stuff. There's a big lament for me in this one, QuickTime Player 7, the QuickTime player that I first ever watched video in way back in the 90s, and I still actually use over the new QuickTime player because I like the shortcuts better, is now end-of-lifed. There will be no QuickTime Player 7 in Catalina. Catalina is killing all the 32-bit apps. So there we are. That is the tech news this week. If you are
I really want to know and follow up next time to just get a sense of how the update went for you and what changes and what, you know, in functionality. Because that's super useful to know when someone's updated.
One of the things is apparently there's going to be big speed improvements because now Metal, the graphics processing in Mac, is all 64-bit native. And apparently we're going to see a whole lot of speed improvements, especially there's a new Final Cut Pro out as well. So we have an article up on that and how you should see some speed bumps. So it'll be interesting to see how Catalina is doing. But you know, remember, as always, filmmakers, just because you can update doesn't mean you have to. And wait at least a couple of weeks if you're in the middle of a project. And if you depend upon any 32-bit software, hang out for a minute and see if the people who made it do a 64-bit version in time for Catalina.
If you've upgraded, also reach out. Let us know how it's going.
Totally. I'm curious. All right. Up next is Ask No Film School.
This week on Ask No Film School, from Christopher McSherry, when should I submit into festivals? I've recently finished editing together a 10-minute short film, and I'm trying to figure out if I should start submitting it into festivals right now, or I should wait till the start of the year, January 2020. I haven't put it up online. I figure since it's the end of the year, most festivals have wrapped up by this point. I should wait until everything starts again next year.
So this is a great question, but it's a bigger question than you actually think you're asking, and that is festival strategy. So what many filmmakers do, especially with their shorts, is they prioritize the bigger festivals first. Because a full festival pass can be 2 years, which doesn't seem very long for, like, I worked on this project for 4 years. But if you worked on a project for 2 months and you're used to sort of YouTube turnaround times, that can feel very long. But so what a lot of filmmakers do is they prioritize the big festivals first, your Torontos, your Sundance, your Slamdance, your South By, your LA Film Fest, your Palm Springs, and they will do a full year applying through those. Sundance and Slamdance, their deadlines are both early September. I think South By's deadline is October. Tribeca's deadline might be December. Tribeca's in April. So you go through that season, and then only once you, if you didn't get into one of those, because the goal is to premiere at a big one if you can. You're going to get the most industry connections. You're going to meet the most people. If your film is short enough, it might get shown in front of a feature, which could get it a lot of good attention. So if you are lucky enough to get into one of the big five, you will then premiere at one of the big five. And then screeners and programmers go to those big festivals, and then you might get invited to a bunch of little festivals and end up with like a 50-festival program of screenings. A lot of filmmakers will spend the full year waiting on those five, and only once they don't get into those five, then they will start strategically looking at sort of the next tier of festivals where they stand a better shot of getting in. You know, because Sundance, I'm sure, gets 10,000 shorts for, you know, 200 slots or something, so it's very competitive. Whereas you start targeting a festival, like if you have a theme, especially, like if you did a children's movie, there's a Hamptons Children's Film Fest, there's the Chicago Independent Children's Film Festival, like there's targeted festivals. However, if you look at your film honestly and you're like, you know, this doesn't really feel Sundance-y or Toronto-y or Slam Dance-y, it is perfectly okay to decide, you know what, I'm going to go a step down first. And that's okay. Because what happens a lot of times is a lot of times people wait that year of going after the big five or six festivals, and then they don't get into any through no fault of their own. It's just their project isn't the right fit for those festivals. And then a year later, they're still eager to get their film out, seen by the world, but it, and now they're going to those second festivals. So sometimes you look at a project and you say, you know what? This particular project is would really be a better fit at the Action on Film Festival because there's a lot of action, or a children's film festival or a horror fest or something like that, depending upon what genre your film is. And it is A-okay to start targeting them strategically. So what you should
do... That is a great... Yeah. Sorry, continue.
Well, no, I was just going to say, like, it's not even about, like, time of year. It's very much about, like, look at the film festivals where you want to screen, and then they'll have their deadlines on their website. Some of them are going to have November and December deadlines, so you shouldn't wait till January to submit, because if one of them has, like, an October 31st deadline, you want to submit now, because if you wait till January, you'll go to their website, and you'll be like, October 31st deadline, I have to wait till next year. Whereas, and there are absolutely... I can't remember what, but somebody I just saw had an October 31st deadline. Maybe it was South By. I don't remember. But South By is a great festival. People really love it. Austin is beautiful. So really start thinking about, like, what are the festivals I might want to go to? And based on that. Now, most short film festivals do not provide transportation. So sometimes with features, like I have friends whose features showed at, like, maybe it's Deauville or Arles, and one of those French festivals, and like they got flown there by the festival. Happens with features. Rarely, if ever, happens with shorts. I can think of one short film festival where the short film filmmakers all got flown out, and that film festival, first off, no longer exists, but secondly, was sponsored by an airline, so it was really easy for the airline to do the flights. So you also want to think strategically about where you want to go and where you can afford to go. So if you're, I don't know where you are, but if you're in Chicago and you don't currently have the budget to fly to Tokyo or to fly to Busan in South Korea, which is totally fair. I mean, I'm not randomly flying to Southeast Asia a lot myself. It's an expensive flight. Maybe you rule out Busan, which is a great film festival, the Busan Film Festival. Maybe you focus instead on, like, the Chicago Independent, Cleveland, like places that you can geographically get to more easily so that you can go. Because part of the fun of a festival is going, is like being there in a room with 200 people when they watch your film, and the laughs get laughs, and the, you know, the emotional experience. And if you've got a drama, like watching people cry over the movie you made is so rewarding. So like there are definitely
opportunity to meet filmmakers.
Oh, yeah.
To meet potential collaborators.
Yeah.
To meet, you know, people in the industry on various levels.
So go. So try and think about festivals you could make it to.
I would add to it, because that's a very thorough answer, that yeah, premiere status is extremely important. And the reason you would want to apply to any big one, meaning like a South By, if you think your film could be there before another one, is that a lot of festivals like a South By won't take you without premiere status.
Yes.
They want to be the first to show it. So that's the other reason you go from the top down in terms of size. My festival experience, my advice would also be, it can become very expensive to submit to all these festivals. They charge you money, usually. If there's any you can get waived fees because maybe you know somebody or you have a connection somewhere, that's worth looking into. I would also add that being local is great because you can go, but if this is going to show a little bit of my bias, if you can get to LA or
yes,
New York
or
for a festival, or of course, if you could get to Sundance,
or
go
Slam
to Sundance.
Dance.
If
yeah.
You or Slam Dance. Slam Dance is just amazing, by the way. And the people there, we've done... Anyway, it's an amazing community that they've created there of filmmakers who are just kind of like... It's more craft and like grassroots focus. But all that aside, my festival experience had a short that did a couple little festivals in Los Angeles. It was you'd be surprised how many agents, managers, and salespeople and reps attend those, because it's easy for them to attend and find new talent. I got repped with my writing partner through at a major agency through that, basically. It wasn't because the movie played at Sundance. It was because it played at a couple little festivals in LA and it had a good reaction. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, if you can get to an LA or New York festival, you have a better chance of getting those eyes on it because the people are just there. But go to any festival you can, because like Charles said, you're going to meet filmmakers. Yeah. Just keep in mind that it's expensive. So you have to spend a lot of money to go and even get into the fest in the first place.
I'm going to wrap up with this. Many of you will have heard this anecdote from me before because I tell it a lot. But a lot of people ask me, like, what's a good strategy for festivals? And I answer what I always answer. But I also like to say the odds are terrible and it's full of chaos. So when I was like, I made my thesis film, Oblivion, Nebraska. I'm very proud of it. It's on Vimeo. Everybody go check it out. I think it's a great little short. And everyone was like, all right, you got to apply to your hometown festival because you've got the hometown advantage and you've got to write a letter to them explaining how you'll bring out all your hometown friends. I'm from the D.C. area, Montgomery County, D.C. suburbs. I'd lived in D.C. for a while after college. D.C. Shorts was like was one of the like top 10 or 15 shorts festivals at the time. So I applied to D.C. Shorts. I wrote this long letter about like, I'm from the area. I have friends from D.C. I have a filmmaking community. I'll bring them all out. D.C. Shorts used to give you your screeners notes. They used to do a thing where, like, as part of your application, you would get the notes from the screener. And I got the notes from the screener. And the notes from the screener were basically, like, the best short film I've ever seen. I got a little teary at the end. We would be so excited to have this as a premiere. It would be so great for this to be here. Highly recommend. A++++. I did not get into DC Shorts. I have no idea why. Maybe there was another short film that was too similar. Maybe, like... Festivals are chaos. So like,
yes, I thought for sure I've targeted festivals that I didn't. It's hit or miss, and you can't know why. That's such a good
and you
such
just
a
can't
good story.
Get hurt yeah. by it. You just yes. can't get hurt by it. So many people I know stake their, you know, like I have friends who are, I have students who are like, this is the perfect festival for me, and I know I'm gonna get there, and then they don't get in, and you know, and it's like it's just. You just apply to another and you apply to another. And my short had a great festival life. I went to a bunch of festivals. I had a lot of fun, a great emotional experience. It got me a feature directing opportunity. It's work I'm still proud of to this day. Like it did all of those things. It did not play at DC Shorts. And I literally don't know why. No idea.
Never will.
Never will. We'll never know. But it's just as likely that it made it to the next round or whatever, and then they were putting together a selection, and it was like one of eight that they were trying to put in a shorts thing. And they're like, well, we have two regional 1960s films about fantasy life. Which one do we keep? And they kept the other one. Like, it is
totally,
like, you know, there's so many variables in why a thing gets made. And what's so funny is, you know, people often, I hear so many theories. You know, from people that are like, oh, well, they must not have liked it because it was too political, or like, oh, they must not have liked it because X. And it's like, literally, it's probably almost always practical. It's probably almost always like, oh, I have something else that's really similar and it's 6 minutes and this is 17 minutes and I can put that 6 minute in front of the, or like, there's so many variables and it's almost probably, I bet sometimes it's personal. I bet sometimes the screener is like, oh, fuck that guy. I met that guy at a party once. He's a dick. But like, it's probably one in 10,000 is it personal, and most of the time it's just logistics.
Yeah. Yes.
Good luck. I hope your short has a long life in festivals, and then after your festival premiere and after you've had some festivals, I hope it you put it online and it has a life and it leads to whatever career opportunities you are hoping it leads to.
Yeah, and update us with what happens.
Yeah.
And how it goes.
Let us know. All right, everybody, that has been the No Film School podcast for this week. If you're interested in more tech news, including a whole lot more discussion of Catalina and Final Cut and Sidecar and all sorts of stuff, you can check out my tech news podcast, The Week in Film Tech. We're available wherever podcasts are. You can see all my articles on No Film School and hit me up on Twitter at Charles Hain and Instagram at Charles Hain. I'm trying to post more on the Insti. And yeah.
And I'm George Edelman at George Edelman on Twitter. You can see the things we're doing over on nofilmschool.com, and you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, and keep listening to the podcast and email us at editor@nofilmschool.com with questions, comments, Even Joker-related hate mail. We're getting plenty of that, too. So
whoa.
Whatever you want.
I'm so glad I don't have to check that email. All right, guys. I'll see everybody next week.